Storius has been formally indicted on a charge of premeditated murder in the shooting death of his girlfriend in South Africa. The double amputee, known as Blade Runner, will stand trial in March for the killing of Reva Steenkamp at his home on Valentine's Day. Pistorius has said he thought he was shooting at an intruder behind a bathroom door. Parts of Russia are dealing with their worst flooding in more than a century. Officials say heavy rains and high water have forced about 20,000 people to flee their homes. Evacuations are underway in three regions along the border with China. That's 3,000 miles east of Moscow. Dozens of towns and villages are struggling with rising floodwaters. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
Today's programming is made possible by Silver Creek in downtown Urbana, serving lunch and dinner every day with a brunch on Sunday. For over 20 years, Silver Creek has served fresh and seasonally current dinners by the fireplace in warm wood ambience. Silver Creek offers over 100 fine wines and draft beers.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. We're not taking calls this hour, but we'll be back live tomorrow at 10 a.m. on WILL AM 580. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest today is Illinois author Jean Thompson, who has set some of her past novels in Illinois, in places like Springfield and Chicago. But actually, this novel takes place mostly in Marin County and San Francisco. And so it's called The Humanity Project. And Jean Thompson, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for having me.
And, you know, I was wondering, you know, this book, it starts out with a mix of different characters. And as a reader, it takes a while before you figure out, you know, who's going to get the most attention and how everybody's going to interact and develop. A lot of them are struggling through various types of bad times. I don't know if this is the dumb author question, but how do you develop this? I mean, did you start with just an idea or a feeling of the times, or did you start with a particular person?
Yes. Yes to all of that. Well, I did start with a kind of a large-scale pondering or question, how do people handle tough times? And that is why so many people are having, you know, difficulties of different sorts that represent challenges that I think people do face these days. Economic, trauma, violence, and simply, the question of how do we cope as human beings and how do we be our best selves? So there was this kind of larger focus, I suppose, in beginning the book. And then the work of the fiction writer is to try and personify that and to come up with characters who will carry forth your notions and your ideas, but also reveal themselves as individuals and maybe get out from under your thumb a little bit and have their own unexpected adventures. So as you begin to locate people, on this large map of strange characters, and my intention was always to start out with disparate characters and then draw them closer together, you might start out with a notion like, well, this is going to be the guy who's having the really tough economic times. But what else can I intuit about him or develop about him or learn about him?
The core group is, I guess, maybe Connor and his dad, Sean.
Yes.
And the girl, is it Lene?
Yes, you could call her that.
Lene and her dad, Art, and they're all different people, but the kids seem to go together in a way. They're both going through tough times. Their fathers are just having trouble coping in different ways.
Yes, that's true. And the younger characters are basically trying to make sense of problems that were visited on them that were not their own fault or of their own making.
That's right. There's economic uncertainty. For Lene, she's survived a school shooting. There are things going on here which just seem to be the sort of problems we're having, or at least we're thinking about,
yes,
right now in the,
yes,
times. And I wondered if that would be a place to ask you to read from the opening of the book, this sort of, I think of it as a Greek chorus.
It is. It's a we. It's a we. And it's something I hadn't done before in any kind of a book, this kind of, oh, overarching, kind of even grandiose voice. But because one of the craft reasons for that is because the book begins with these disparate characters in different places doing different things, and it takes a while for them to physically come together, I wanted to give the reader something to go on, you know, that I do have a purpose here or an intention or a sort of theme I'm announcing. So this is page one, chapter one. We were afraid of so many things, of our children who lived in their own world of casually lurid pleasures, zombies and cartoon killers and thuggish music, of our neighbors who were buying gold and ammunition and great quantities of freeze-dried food and who were organizing themselves into angry tribes recognizable to one another by bumper stickers. We feared that our lives had been spent in piling up not treasures, but great heaps of discardable and wasteful things. Television voices exhorted us to buy even more, and often enough we did, even though money seemed to be draining away from us like water in a leaky sink, and most of all, we feared a future of privation and loss. Our politicians were no help at all. We feared those people who we believed meant to do us harm, although such fears fluctuated along with the most recent headlines. There were people who hated us with ancient, inexplicable, and undying hatreds. They might look harmless enough, unexceptional, but without warning they might precipitate some majestic destruction that we could not imagine, or no, we could imagine it all too well, the fire, the choking ash, the impossibly small spaces that our bodies would be made to fit.
And that's from the opening of the Humanity Project, and that Greek chorus sort of voice sort of reappears at times.
A couple of times, yeah, more, yes, it does.
You know, I'm wondering, I read those passages, I think that it really is about right now.
Unfortunately, it is, yes.
I wonder, at some point, you know, it will no longer be those times, and somebody's going to pick up this book at the library or wherever and read the opening section, and that's going to be history for them, and they're going to trust you that that's what it was like.
Well, it's a nice thought to imagine that I will be read in, you know, times to come. You never know. But yes, I think that fiction can serve as our introduction to times past. A Tale of Two Cities, perhaps. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there are things that we know through novels, through Jane Austen. You know, what else do we know about early, you know, 18th century, about 18th century social customs?
History books are not going to touch on that same sort of thing the way Jane Austen did.
They don't seem to, no.
When did the times, that is, the times we're in right now, when did they seem to gel together to you that we're living with the problems we have right now?
Well, certainly, you know, the catastrophe that I'm referencing that I just read is an echo of 9/11, although, you know, certainly reading it right now, a week after the Boston Marathon bombings, it echoes again, unfortunately. But I also think the recent recession that we're still struggling through. So, you know, post 9/11, post-present economic catastrophe, I think that was what gave the book the flavor of, well, I hope not, we're all doomed, but, you know, the times are bad for many people in unexpected ways.
Mm-hmm. You know, besides the characters who are very obviously struggling, there's, you know, one central character who's sort of a mover and shaker in the book, and that's Mrs. Foster.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And she's struggling in her own way. She's widowed very early in the book.
Yes.
And she's living out there alone with her feral cats?
Yes, yes. Well, she has been in a long and somewhat difficult marriage, and her husband died, and they were wealthy, and she has decided to, in a sense, despite her late husband, I think, to spend some of his money improving the lives of humanity in some, you know, vague way. She hasn't really thought this out very well, but she's going to, you know, kind of give herself a new mission in life, I think. I think it revives her a great deal to be not just the widow with poor health, but, you know, to have a reason to get up and dress up and to order people around and write checks. And, you know, she really thrives and comes into her own through this foundation.
And the idea she comes up with is that she'll pay people to be good.
She hasn't thought it out very well, as I said. But you never really see this project doing wonderful things, although we're told they make donations to soup kitchens and homeless shelters and things like that. But she wants something large and grand about the nature of humanity and whether you can have economic incentives to be virtuous, mm-hmm. which opens up a whole can of worms.
It's not that she hadn't thought about the problem. You have her discussing the idea that, you could provide for everybody's needs. And,
yes.
and certainly the characters in your novels have gravely serious physical or psychological needs.
Yes.
You could provide for all that, but they would still do bad things because of the nature of humanity.
Well, and this is the question, you know, who are we and what kind of a creature are we and how do we respond to bad fortune and to good fortune? And, you know, I don't come up with any answers, you know, shockingly, you know, but it does, that question is posed and that is a motivating question in the book.
Do you see some people or organizations sort of, I don't know if spinning the wheels is the right word, but essentially trying to answer unanswerable questions, as one of the people involved with the foundation puts it?
Well, I think that's our lot in life, is to spin our wheels and try and move the wheel just a little bit forward. And people do. I mean, you know, you could argue that the glass is half full. You could. I'm more of the glass is half empty and the glass is broken kind of a girl, but that's just me.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with writer Jean Thompson. And her new novel is called The Humanity Project. It's published by Penguin's Blue Writer Press. You can find out more about Jean Thompson online at jeanthompsononline.com. And that's Jean spelled J-E-A-N. Now, you noted to me as we were talking before the show that little bit on the copyright page selling that, you know, events here are entirely fictional and they have nothing to do with any other people or organizations or anything. Which is why it tickled me so much to Google the Humanity Project and find that there is a charitable organization called the Humanity Project.
And I'm so glad this is a local show because that means my editor is not listening and grinding her teeth and saying, why didn't we do that? But yes, the lawyers put in the, no, we weren't talking about you. And it really is funny, you know, to hear this. This is the first I've heard of it. But yes, all the people are made up.
Okay.
All
well,
of them.
In this totally no connection to the novel, never heard of it before, website called thehumanityproject.com. Here's the opening welcome message. Our tax-exempt 501c3 nonprofit group passionately believes society can improve if individuals understand why they benefit from moving beyond a purely self-centered life. We offer practical psychology-based ways for both kids and grown-ups to act not for me alone, but rather for us.
I like these people. I'm going to send them a check. I think I ought to.
In a way, it and I don't want to cast any aspersions or anything on this genuine organization in Florida at thehumanityproject.com, but it sounds like there's a Mrs. Foster there.
Well, although from just what you read, it sounds like they are into psychological services, which is a worthy and more focused endeavor than Mrs. Foster ever came up with.
Okay. And
This is where I get to the point in asking, you know, this is a work of fiction. You're a writer, and you've been writing about, well, all the reviews seem to talk about your gift for writing about ordinary people. Do you think of them that way, that these are people, if not uninteresting, but they're not the glamour pusses of the
world?
Well,
most of us are ordinary. I mean, I'll cop to that. And, you know, I was thinking I'm sure this is a long ago college professor or something who said, you know, once Freud came up with the Oedipus complex and saying, look, this dramatic situation that was about kings and queens really applies to ordinary people, you know, that ordinary people are subjects, you know, or have been through, you know, much of modern and contemporary literature. You mean there are still TV shows about, you know, celebrities. We love celebrities and you know, movie stars and rich people. But that's a kind of pressing our nose against the glass, looking at these other more glamorous lives. Most of us are not glamorous.
Well, in your own reading, when you were growing up, what was the fiction that attracted you? Was there a time when you read about the glamorous people?
No, I was one of those weird kids that, you know, the parents were always saying, quit reading and go outside. And, you know, my folks had a whole library of old college books and things, and I was reading Chekhov at 12, which, of course, it was way above me, and I did not understand. But, you know, I remember my mother saying, why are you reading that? It's so depressing. You know, so I was reading and reading and reading whatever I could get my hands on, and I probably read more then than I do now, just because life is more hectic. But I think I read, I don't want to brag and say every classic in the world, but sometimes it feels like that, you know, and I certainly couldn't take a test on many of these things now, but I certainly read Chekhov and Dickens, and I read Shakespeare with the help of annotations, and I have a thorough grounding in the classic canon. I think that's fair to say.
Do you think that affects your own writing in any way that you can see?
That's a good question. That I think I could just say that I was very traditionally grounded. I've never been, you know, a flaming experimentalist in my writing. You know, that fiction seemed pretty basic to me in terms of telling a story and wanting a reader to know what happens next. That I've never been known for being breaking traditions. I'm just an old-fashioned girl, Jim.
I mean, besides, you talk about the classic canon. Were there contemporary authors that made an impression from you, that saying that, you know, I want to write like them, or I want to write in my own way and that reaches the same sort of nut they're trying to crack?
Well, again, I was very much an omnivore, and so all of the moderns and contemporaries, you know, Raymond Carver, hugely influential, Flannery O'Connor. You know, these aren't moderns or contemporaries, but the Russian writers Tolstoy and Gogol and Turgenev, I could go on, but it's just kind of a repetitive, you know, Penguin will like this, the Penguin Classic series.
So not, know? Say, Dashiell Hammett, J.R.R. Tolkien. There are certain areas we're not going to.
Well,
Barbara Cartland.
I love The Hobbits. You know, I'm a big fan. I try and reread The Lord of the Rings once every year, all three books. I love them. But I've never been, you know, if you say genre, it sounds pejorative, and I don't mean that, but I've never said, oh, if only I could write a good crime, you know, novel. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe one day I will, you know, never say never, but I was never enraptured by that or by bodice rippers or, you know, mm-hmm. some of the popular niches, you know, vampires in love. You
or
know,
even
sort of
even
thing.
Going to other historical periods or places. I mean, when you write, you see in this book, it takes place in Marin County, but it's somewhere in America for practical purposes.
Well, yeah. Well, historical fiction, you have to actually work hard and do research, you know, perish the thought. So, no, I'm a creature of my time and place.
And the people, so to speak, I'm not asking if there are any particular people involved, but they're just sort of hanging around all around you.
Well, they come full-fledged from my head. They are not based on models. I think when I was a younger writer, it was easier to maybe make use of models, people you know that you know, then you mess with them. You know, you give them red hair instead of black or something. But, you know, I am less interested in working with models. I mean, characters now, it will disappoint everybody I know who has any secret hope or fear of ending up as one of my characters. But honestly, I make them up.
Mm-hmm. Some of the reviews I've read praised, and it looked good to me, I mean, the way that you write about young people and how they talk together.
I hope so.
So that is something that some writers, you know, unless you have them hanging around, that you can certainly get wrong.
Snooping and spying, yeah. Well, no, I mean, I'm not young anymore, but I used to be. So, you know, I mean, I've had that experience. And, you know, writers have to be observant, you know, and sometimes just a very chance encounter with people that you never actually meet, you know, somebody you overhear in the grocery store or some other venue like that, can be illuminating. At least if you are a writer, you start thinking about, well, why did they say that? And I wonder, they looked like they were mad about, well, you know, what's going on here? This is what writers are always doing. It's a terrible character flaw. but you can pick up, I guess, enough from the atmosphere of walking through your day. Flannery O'Connor, again, said anybody who doesn't have enough to write about by the time they're 10 years old really isn't a writer.
Okay, so that's the time. Well, when you were 10 years old, did you have a clue that you might be doing this?
Oh, no, of course not. I had no clue as to anything.
When did you actually try writing seriously?
When I was a college student, I thought, oh, I'll take a writing class. And that was a very, you know, kind of casual whim sort of thing that probably was a little bit more than that. So when I was a college student, you know, just, oh, let's try this for fun. But, you know, maybe somewhere you're lying to yourself and saying, yeah, but you really want to do this, don't you?
And it turned out you did. It was,
you know, it took me a while, but yes. And I think that is actually, people always say, what's the hardest thing about writing? And I used to ask writing students this and tell them there's no wrong answer. And they'd come up with all sorts of, you know, worthy responses. Oh, the hardest thing is beginnings. The hardest thing is endings. The hardest thing is language. And my answer to that unanswerable question is the hardest thing is taking yourself seriously. Because then you have to be worried about failing.
About taking it more, it's not just a hobby. It's not just something I'm doing for a lark.
Exactly.
And therefore, you can't quit, no matter how.
Well, now you make it sound like the ballet story of the red shoes. You know,
well, that, I don't mean it that way.
Maybe
I should say that you can't give up just because you hit a difficult patch.
Well, I think if you are going to be a writer, you need to persevere because the world does not make it easy to write. I mean, the world does not care if you never write another word. You know, the world goes on about its business. You have to care. You have to have enough perseverance and discipline and perhaps stubbornness also.
Okay. Well, it is time for a short break right now, and we will be back on Focus with Jean Thompson to talk more about writing and her new novel, The Humanity Project.
This is Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and you're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous program.
T.E. Lawrence was immortalized in the film Lawrence of Arabia. On The Next Fresh Air, writer Scott Anderson tells us about the real Lawrence, a man who seemed to be preparing himself for greatness even as a young boy.
He would try to stay awake for days at a time. He would deny himself food, deny himself water, for as long as he could physically endure.
Anderson's new book is Lawrence in Arabia. Join us.
weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programming is made possible by Sinfonia de Camera, introducing their 30th season with a gala celebration on Sunday, September 15th at 6 p.m. in the Krannert Center lobby. The evening will feature music, dancing, dinner, and a live auction. More information is available at the Sinfonia office at 244-4350.
Historical treasures are buried in the archives of libraries nationwide, and there's a project underway to make them available to everyone.
Think of the amazing stuff that's there, whether it's the first photograph of the moon, and they have some amazing photographs of the civil rights movement.
The Digital Public Library of America. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of a previous Focus program. We're not taking calls this hour, but we'll be back live tomorrow at 10 a.m. on WILL AM 580.
I'm Jim Meadows. We're back on Focus with Illinois author Jean Thompson. She's author of 5 short story collections and now 6 novels, with the latest being The Humanity Project. You mentioned, Jean, a little while back in the interview that you're sort of a glass half empty sort of person.
Oh, you say that like it's a bad thing.
Well, I was noticing that, and this is not a novel where people prevail heroically. I was happy to see that. You like your characters. You can tell that. It's good to spend time with your characters, even when they're going through terrible things. And they seem to come out at the end of the book sort of okay.
For one of my books, yes, they're okay.
Oh, there's... So there's well, there's no pattern with the other ones.
I don't think so, no. Okay. But no, they're... I suppose I could say it's my version of happy endings. We're not any worse off than when we started, and sometimes we're better.
You know, I felt that a lot of the characters are battling their own personal demons. They're a lot of the times their own worst enemy.
Certainly.
And even though they come out okay by the end of the book, they haven't necessarily conquered those defects in themselves. Maybe the young people who are still growing up have made some real progress, but people who are, well, my age
or they're, mine
they're pretty much who they're going to be, it seems.
Well, yes, but I think many of them end up in different places or in different combinations, or they're still hanging in there. I guess I'd say that. And some of them have gone through bad times and come out on the other end.
I think of the two fathers in the book. There's Art and
yes.
Sean. Sean is someone who's He had been a blue collar worker, physical work. He's not getting work now. Then he's hurt in an auto accident in a big plot complication.
Yes.
He's chronic pain, addiction to painkillers. I mean, everything's really on the
I really clobbered the guy, I have to say. but I like him, I mean, you feel a little bit like God increasing the sufferings of Job, for a while here. But yes, I gave him more than a plateful of trouble.
And Art, who is maybe a little higher on the socioeconomic scale than Sean, but really not all that much when you add everything together.
He's not prosperous, and he is has not lived up to his potential, I think it would be fair to say. He is a part-time college teacher. He's a part-time this. He's a part-time that. He gets by, but he is the kind of guy who always has a new project or a new plan that never quite gets off the ground. He's been able to have the luxury of being irresponsible.
And all of a sudden, his daughter is plunked back into his life.
Yes.
He's divorced, so the daughter has been with them. With her mother for all these years.
Yes.
When things really get bad with her because of everything that I'm not going to give details about,
okay,
connected with the school shooting, she's essentially dumped into the lap of art.
Yes. Her mother, who has remarried, just says, I can't carry on my life with this out-of-control child. Here, you take her.
And this actually gives Art a new project, which he's obviously not very good at, but at the same time, it seems to put a new line of continuity into his life.
Well, yes, it does. It moves him forward. He's not one of the more evolved characters. In fact, at one point, I had so much fun doing this. He dresses up for Halloween as a caveman, because he is kind of a caveman. He's mm-hmm. just not going to get some things together. But nothing too terrible happens to him. We see him at the end, and he may have even, evolved in spite of himself.
One of the characters who seems to be more evolved, I'm not quite sure at the end, is Christy.
Yes.
And Christy is, how would you describe her?
She did become important in the book. She is a neighbor of Art. She is a nurse, and she tends to Mrs. Foster. So we're making, these connections. And then she also, in various plot complications, runs into these other characters. So they all start kind of being in the same network. But she is someone who feels very much feels the desire to want to be a good person. And she does not really know how to go about that. But she is painfully conscious of her own nature. And is she nice enough and clever enough and kind enough? And no, she's not. And she is eventually the person whom Mrs. Foster puts in charge of the Humanity Project, even though she has no clue as to how to do this. So she becomes, in a way, the Humanity Project. How does she cope with her own nature and her own detachment and her own failures as she sees them of, lack of charity and lack of understanding?
She seems to be the one who's the most aware of both,
yes,
her limitations and other people's limitations in a
yes.
compassionate way.
Yes, I think she's sympathetic, but she feels herself as, detached, failed, cold, inadequate in ways that have to do with human nature. That she's not a touchy-feely, empathetic, she's more of a standoffish, leave me alone, I want to meditate. You see her meditating or trying to.
Is she, at some points I felt and this is where I realized I could get things wrong, because she was one of the more observant of the characters, that she was in some ways your point of view for as close as any of the characters got, your point of view on the story as a whole.
I think that's fair to say, because she is observant, because she's more self-aware, I think, because she's not always consumed by her own self. And so she's looking at these other specimens of humanity and saying, oh, poor Art or poor Linnea or poor Mrs. Foster or, how do I cope with these people?
And in the end, I'm not going to give that part away,
no.
But she does do something surprising at the end.
Oh, yeah.
I could clearly see a sequel here if he wanted to do that sort of thing.
Oh, no. I think I'll let them live happily ever after on the last page.
You've taught creative writing.
Yes.
In the past. And I'm wondering, of course, it's always a trick how someone goes about teaching writing, because there are certain things you can't really diagram on the chalkboard.
So oh, you kick them off the end of the dock and hope they can swim. really. Well, you have to be a reader to be a writer. And so any writing class that I ever taught, we read models. And for writing classes of the sort I taught, you're really talking about short fiction. So you read a number of models of short fiction. And writers have to learn how to look at writing in terms of technique. Okay, so you start with, you read something, you like it or you don't like it. Well, what are the things that are leading you to this response? And what has the author done? How have they manipulated the writing? What are the tricks that you can use? If you like this particular kind of writing, how could you replicate it? What is it that you're responding to? So a lot of it is just beginning with your own response to writing. And, you know, you hope that, people have at least thought about that, but, you know, maybe not. But so there's a certain amount of leading people through, you know, how you respond as a writer to writing, in the same way how a painter might respond to a painting or a musician to a piece of music. You know, there's a technical aspect to it. And then there's a vocabulary that goes along with that, so that we're, by the end of a semester, we're all sitting there going, oh, look at this unnecessary foreshadowing. You know, and you know, your pacing was really off here, but I really did like what you did with your exposition. You know, in other words, you're talking in the driest possible terms, as opposed to, but I didn't like it, or I liked it.
And there is, of course, in doing anything, there's technique. And if you're the one doing it, you know where, essentially, you know where all the rivets are that's holding everything together. But at the same time, there's got to be something more than just the technique. Well, I assume so, anyway.
Well, I used to say this tiresomely again and again, that writers have to be successful schizophrenics, you know, that you have to have whatever impels you to write, whatever is murky and unformed and passionate and dark in you. And at the same time, you have to be that calm, cool editor of yourself that, you know, draws back from the page and says, no, I think I need another scene in here. And oh, no, this just isn't working. So you have to be both of those creatures, the creature that just wants to kind of, you know, put something forth on a page, you know, all the emotion or chaos of your emotions, and at the same time, the person who forms and shapes it.
When you're spending times with characters, especially for something the length of a novel, do you feel that there are more things that you know, so to speak, about them than what goes on the page?
No, surprisingly not. I only know what I put down in writing. And they don't really have those traits until I put them down. So I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, but supposedly Fitzgerald wrote 50-page biographies of his characters before he wrote about them. No, I don't need to know their favorite color or their shoe size or
whatever. So if you don't say what the hair color is.
Well, there's all sorts of reasons you may or may not, you know, use somebody's hair color. It's an identifier.
Yeah.
But no, I know what's important about them for my purposes.
Mm-hmm. Is there a point where you get at where you can say to yourself, my character would do this, my character would not do that?
I think I go step by step. You know, I mean, once in a while there's a plot point where I say, yeah, I have to have this guy end up in this place, therefore he has to do this. But I think if you don't give the writing process room to surprise you as you're, you know, going about your business, then it gets boring, you know. Now, and I don't want to sound like I'm one of these writers that says, oh, my characters just live their own lives and surprise me and haunt me and appear on the staircase, you know, or something like that. You know, they're very much under my thumb, you know, but sometimes if you get to a certain point in a narrative where you've led a character along, then you do find yourself asking, how would they respond? I have a little bit of grounding in them now.
And maybe the other question is, what would have to happen to make them respond in this particular way?
Exactly. And how do I maneuver them how do I keep all these balls in the air? How do I keep the momentum going forward? How do I give the reader the information they need? How do I create a kind of tension or suspense that will keep people reading?
How much revision goes into your writing? You have to go where you're thinking, well, this plot thread, no, I've decided that's not going to go there. This character is not going to be here, or something like that.
I'm pretty much a put one line of bricks down and then make sure that's sound and then put the second line of bricks down. So I revise as I go. And usually what I'm doing is rereading from the beginning, you know, last day's work. And, you know, is this okay? Yes, I think it's okay. I think I can take another step forward. I think I can put another brick on that wall. So rather than writing a draft and then going back and you know, redoing the whole thing from the beginning, which many writers do, by the time I reach the end of the draft, I'm pretty happy with it.
Okay. Well, I think we have a call, and I'm going to find out who it is here on line one. Line one, John in Champaign. Good morning. You're on the air on Focus.
Hi. I had a question, but it's probably off the wall. I was wondering what the Tajine is it?
Yes.
What she thought about memoirs and has she written one and would she write one?
Oh, what do I think about memoirs? I love reading other people's. I don't think I'm going to write one myself. I want to read the writer Edna O'Brien has a memoir coming out that I just ordered a sample of it on Kindle. You know, I got the free sample. It's called Country Girl, and she lived this. Has lived. I mean, she's 82 and she's still going strong. But, you know, memoirs, I think, John, what you're probably talking about is this glut of memoirs that we've seen, you know, coming across our bookshelves, that everybody feels they have a memoir in them, that it's been a very popular form. Are you thinking of some particular memoirs?
No.
Okay.
No, I've always thought about putting a lot of things down and then trying one myself.
Well, I think everyone is entitled to, you know, and I think they can make interesting reading. And we've had this whole kerfuffle lately about, you know, are memoirs verifiable? Are people, you know, if you're writing your own version of your own story, you know, you can go to town. You can,
you can
get back at people who did you wrong. You know, you can do all of these things.
No, I wouldn't write that. Why don't you think you would write one?
Because my format, at this point at least, is fiction. Maybe 20 years from now, come around to, you know, I won't care. Most everybody will be dead, you know. you know, it won't matter what I say. As for now, I mean, you've only got so much energy as a writer. And never say never, but as for now, I'm a fiction girl.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your question.
John, thank you very much for calling. And this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and still time for your questions for writer Jean Thompson, author of The Year We Left Home, Wild Blue Yonder, and her latest novel, The Humanity Project. Call in at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. That's illinois.edu. We do have a question that's come in online. How hard is it to get published today? Do you have any advice for people with book ideas who are too intimidated? Maybe that's the danger part, intimidation, to try to put together a proposal, because how much uncertainty is facing the publishing industry?
That's a good question, and I will try and give you my best advice, which is the publishing industry is in a great deal of flux right now. The inauguration of ebooks and publishing online and self-publishing has everyone in a dither. So, yes, traditional publishing where there's an agent system and an editor and you know, a narrow gate you have to get through, I think, can be very frustrating. You know, many are called and few are chosen, and people are rejected constantly and continuously for all the wrong reasons. So there is a lot of frustration in that. There is also now, you can now self-publish, and people do that. I think that has its own perils, mostly that people can't find your book or can't read it, but there are people who make a success of it. But backing away from publishing per se for a minute, I would say if you want to write and if you're finding it daunting, the best thing you can do is find yourself some kind of an audience. whether that's a local writing group, whether that's going to writing conferences, whether that's finding a writing group online, because really, you know, it's lonesome work. It's isolated work. And if you can find yourself a way to make it a little bit less isolating and intimidating through any number of outlets, I think you could find that nourishing.
We have another caller on line four, Craig in Park Forest. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to, it's a wonderful conversation. And I apologize if this has already been covered because I did come in a little bit late into the conversation. But I'm always fascinated with people like yourself, ma'am, who are writers. How do you get started? I mean, how does someone get started in the game? I mean, yourself. I mean, do you just sit there and then all of a sudden the idea comes into your head, I want to write a novel about this, or is it just, I mean, I'm always fascinated by how people who do what you do for a living, How do you start?
Hi, Craig. I'm laughing a little bit. What I do for a living? Well, it's sort of a living, you know. For most of us, keep our day jobs. I would say at this point, having done this all my adult life, you know, work habits can kind of save you. That there's a point at which you sit down and say, what is going on in my head, and what sort of thing do I want to put on a page? That I'm familiar with that process by now, and so some of the habit kind of takes over. But there's always a kind of stage where I call it the portable phase of writing something, which is the easiest because you can walk around and think about it in your head, and you haven't done the hard work of sitting down and putting it on a page. You know, once you commit to putting something on a page, although, of course, you can go back and change it, you've ruined your beautiful ideal of what you're going to write by making it tangible. You know, you're the sculptor who's taken that first tap of the hammer to the beautiful block of marble. Oh, no, you know, you've made a commitment. So, you know, there's thinking about it, and thinking about it is, there's no good answer to that process. You know, what is it that is calling to you? What is it that has an urgency? And also, you know, to some extent, what are you in the mood to do? You know, something lighthearted, something grand, something in between. But then once you get, once you get rolling with it, once you commit to it, it gets a little bit easier. Does that answer your question at all?
Yes, it does. If I may follow up just a little bit, like when you write a novel, do you say, okay, here's kind of how I want the novel to end, or have an outline as to how you want the span of the characters, their arc to be, or is it you just kind of start to say, I have this idea about something I want to write about, and then it just kind of builds on itself?
The latter. If there are no surprises in the process, if I was just filling in an outline, I'd get so bored.
Okay, well, that's really fascinating. Thank you for answering my question. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Craig.
And good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. And I should note that in the Humanity Project, there are surprises. There are things that happen that someone could have planned in advance, but it sounds like it came to you as you were developing the writing all along.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. Although there were these moments with some of the plot twists that I really had to congratulate myself. Ha 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 ha! Yeah, you know, look, I could do this. You know, there are these. You know, it's not all suffering. There are these moments of great, you know, self satisfaction and gratification. You know,
are you? And I don't know how you pace yourself with this. Are you working on something now? Do you take a breather as when you're promoting a book?
Well, there are always breathers that interfere. Like, you know, I have to go to the dentist at 2 o'clock and get a tooth taken care of, which fortunately is not acting up enough for me to be unable to talk to you today. But you know, there are always life events and things. But you know, writers, anyone who practices an art form feels vaguely guilty and uneasy when they're not practicing their art. So yes, I'm always writing or trying to write.
You set this book in a certain context of the times.
Do you think that the times when you were talking about the economic uncertainty, the social uncertainty of everything from 9/11 to, I guess, the Boston Marathon bombings,
sure.
Do you think that's going to continue into your work for a while, or are there other ways to approach people, or are the times going to change?
Well, I'm doing something completely different now, which is, I don't want to give too much away, but I'm writing some stories. And I'm writing some stories that I would say use fairy tales and folk tales as a point of departure. They're not necessarily versions of it. So, yeah, it couldn't be more different. But what if, for example, Hansel and Gretel were neglected children who wound up in foster care, you know, that sort of thing. And I'm having a blast, you know, probably because it's so different.
That's certainly a different context. And it's also, I don't know, as you started to write novels, if you wrote fewer short stories or if you had been doing them all along.
I tend to alternate, and part of, I think, the reason I'm taking a kind of a 90-degree turn doing something different is just keeping yourself amused, you need to, at least I need a certain amount of novelty. Yeah.
Approaching short fiction, is that different for you from approaching a novel, besides the fact you know that it's supposedly going to be completed more quickly?
Yeah, I think that's the main difference. And also, I mean, I began as a short story writer rather than naturally being a novelist. And, so it's sort of like coming home to me, writing shorter fiction.
Okay. What are you reading right now?
Well, I want to read the Edna O'Brien memoir. I read a very good novel by my friend Pete Rock called The Shelter Cycle, which is a new book and which is based on a religious sect which operated in Montana in the 90s called the Church Universal and Triumphant. And they decided the end of the world was near and they all had to go live underground, which they did, a great number of them, and then had to come out years later saying, oh, the world is still here. The Shelter Cycle by Pete Rock. So I'm very happy to plug that one.
And I notice if you go to your website, GeneThompsonOnline.com, you do have other recommendations on other people's books.
And I need to update that. I've been very lazy, yes. But, yes, that should be part of spreading the word, I think.
Well, we've been talking today with Central Illinois author Gene Thompson, and her new book is The Humanity Project. It's published by Penguin's Blue Writer Press, and you can find out more about it at Gene's website, GeneThompsonOnline, that's one word, .com. Gene, thank you very much for being with us on Focus today.
Thank you, Jim. And everybody out there, support WILL. I do.
I'm Jim Meadows, and you've been listening to an encore presentation of Focus on WILL. Tune in for conversations about issues and ideas that affect your life each weekday morning at 10, with a replay at 8 p.m. We welcome any additional comments or questions you have about today's show on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Other members of the Focus team are Pam Dempsey and Kimberly Cronick. Jason Croft is our technical director. You can always find free downloadable podcasts of the show on our website, and you can also find Focus on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. This is Focus on WILL AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM. Their FarmerView mobile site features up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids, and offers ADM customers access to contracts, deliveries, and payments. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where soybean and wheat export inspections were deemed bullish by analysts today, while corn export inspections were deemed bearish. Corn Weekly export inspections came in at 7.1 million bushels. That's well below the 19.2 million needed to stay on pace with USDA's demand projection of 715 million bushels for the year. Soybean weekly export inspections were 5.3 million bushels. That's above the 4.0 million needed to stay on pace with USDA's projection of 1.315 billion bushels. And weekly wheat export inspections came in at 33.8 million bushels, as well above the pace of 20.5 million needed to stay on pace with USDA's demand projection of 1.100 billion bushels. But the key feature today thus far moving the markets higher is weather. A 10-day forecast of hot and dry conditions has bulls pushing both corn and soybean prices significantly higher today. Let's look at the particulars. Begin in the wheat pit, though. Hard red winter wheat for December at 7.10 and a half, up 8 and a quarter. Soft December at 6.52 and a quarter, up 8 and three quarters. September corn 4.84 and three quarters, up 11. December 4.76 and three quarters, up 13 and a quarter. September soybeans 13.14 and a half, up 31 and a quarter. November 12.95 and a quarter, now a half, up 36 and a quarter. September soybean meal 4.16.50, up 7.70. September soybean oil 43.47 is up 66. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.